You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And tonight we have Dr. Eric Carlstrom, is a professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years of teaching experience. And he's back with us, and Joan Vian, our special guest, who is a businesswoman and international reporter who has covered over 100 global meetings around the world since 1994. And her website is www.womensgroup.org. And Eric and Joan, welcome. And Eric, do you have anything you want to start out and address with our prestigious guest?
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to be able to talk to Joan again. Melody, we had Joan on before, and there's an excellent interview that's archived on your website, khen.org. Also on my website, I have several websites. I have one on www.911nwo.com, and Joan's interview we did with Joan is there, and also I summarized that. So we found that Joan has an unusually broad perspective based on her many experiences with international meetings over the world over the last 15, 16 years. So she understands the big picture better than almost anybody, and so it's a pleasure to be able to talk to Joan again and get an update. I know she's been studying the impacts of the credit crisis, but maybe perhaps, Joan, we should start with you giving a little background of your research interests and then take it from there.
Okay. I'm an American. I'm an American first. I am a Christian by way of my values and my world outlook. I don't have any particular emphasis with regard to my Christianity other than living and showing Jesus on a daily basis. Having said that, as a businesswoman in 1990, I read a book called Euroquake. And I was very interested in this book because this man, a very well-known writer, Daniel Burstein, had interviewed people for over a year all over the world, whether they were world leaders or CEOs of corporations or economists, scientists, academicians. I really slaughtered that word. Anyway, geniuses. And so he had interviewed all these people, and he had come up with this book in which he was giving 100 predictions for the 1990s. And so I thought that was a book I should buy and read, which I did. And he at that time was talking about trade zones, but he didn't call them trade zones. He had another name for them because that was the name that they were using at that time. They were called the triads, that there would be three lateral zones of business. And what really intrigued me was the fact that he predicted that there would be, and he didn't put it in these words, but he described it, some type of world currency by the end of the 1990s. And I was so struck with that. It just really hit me between the eyes, and I thought, you know, you don't have a world currency unless there's a world government, because that's the purpose of currency. But I didn't know if there was world government. People were talking about the New World Order. That's the only phrase that people were using at that time. The United Nations had been set up in 1945, and they were doing their thing somewhere. I collected money for UNICEF, and that's all I knew about the United Nations. You very rarely heard anything about them in the newspaper or on TV. That didn't happen until about 2000. Then all of a sudden it was like the United Nations was unveiled, but this was 1990. And so I started praying and asking God to show me, where is world government in the world? In 1994, I had a lady friend who is an ardent pro-lifer invite me, she challenged me to go to Cairo, where the United Nations was hosting a conference on how to reduce the population of the world. Well, that wasn't really my thing, and so, you know, I told her, that's not my thing, I'm not interested, blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, I won't go into all the details, but I ended up going. And I ended up going because I thought, you know, the World Bank is going to be there and the International Monetary Fund, and it's a United Nations conference. Maybe it's time I go and see what these organizations are. The only way you can get into these meetings is either as a reporter or as a non-governmental organization. Well, I didn't even know what that thing was, an NGO. It's basically a non-profit group that is approved by the United Nations. And so I went as a reporter the first time ever. You know, all I knew was who, what, when, where, and why. I didn't know anything about anything, but I was going. And it changed my life. On the third day, I figured out all the actors, all the players, the agenda. Okay, I didn't know anything, a lot about anything, but what I realized after the third day of listening and watching and observing was that I was seeing world government in action. And that idea just blew my mind. That here was world government. Here was, quote unquote, the New World Order. And I gathered up as much data as I could, and I came home. And I went through a suitcase full of material to figure out how big, how vast, how deep, how broad was this agenda. I was just shocked. I mean, we weren't hearing this on the news. We weren't reading about any of this in the newspaper. Nobody was connecting the dots. I was a very active member of the Republican Party, and I live right outside of Washington, D.C. And I thought that I was sophisticated. No, no, no. And I thought I knew something. No, I didn't know a cotton-picking thing. Because even the Republican Party wasn't talking about the international level. And so I made a commitment to God that I would go and I would cover as many global meetings as he opened the doors for. And I won't go into all the details on how I did that. It was all done through, you know, the legal channels and all of that. But I reported for USA Radio News Network for 14 years. They're no longer around. And I now report for KFER in California, a radio station. And God just opened doors. It was amazing. I have covered 109 global meetings. The last global meeting that I was at was the G20 in Pittsburgh. I have done the Bank for International Settlements, which is very powerful, very key, and everything that's happening even today with the credit crises and the changes going on financially and economically in the world. I went to the United Nations in New York. I went to the United Nations in Geneva. I went to the IMF World Bank meetings. Thank God they're only an hour away from where I live. You know, I don't have to fly anywhere. I have been to a very broad section, whether it's world trade, whether it's environmental, whether it's economic, whether it is the International Criminal Court, or whether it is, the Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space Conference, whether it is, you know, just so many different. And that's where I got my understanding. How I think as an individual is that I have to see the forest, and then I can understand the tree. And so as I started recognizing that we were in world government, my first chore that I felt I needed to find was what were the major structures, what were the major components and pieces of this new world governmental system. So I started looking for those major pieces. And then the next thing was, who were the major power players? And I can say if people go to my website, womensgroup.org, WOMENSGROUP, womensgroup.org, and you go look at my resume, and I have a list of people I've interviewed, that is very, very partial. Trust me. I never, ever thought when I started in 1994 that I would do this for 15, 16 years and that I would have the ability to query and interview the kinds of people that I have. I mean, we are talking Paul Volcker, we're talking Alan Greenspan, we're talking Tony Blair, we're talking Robert Rubin, we're talking Larry Summers, we're talking George Bush II, many, many, many people, not only from our government and from other governments, but CEOs of major corporations, people from all over the world, people throughout the whole United Nations infrastructure. Now, let me just say that if you're going to interview somebody, you've got to know what to do. You have to know the agenda. You have to know, quote unquote, the most recent document. And I have done a lot of reading. I mean, I can, because of where I have been, because of the number of conferences or types of conferences that I've gone to, I can basically pull from the environmental and ask an economic question. I can pull from the economic and ask a social question or whatever the case may be. So I never, ever thought. But you see, it was like I had my hand on this huge animal, if you will, a rhinoceros or something, and I could not let go because I was in the process of identifying the various components. And I would say for your listeners that I have a number of videos, Sustainable Feudalism, the 2008 credit crisis, when central banks rule the world, and world government convergence. Those are my four most recent. They can call 301-371-0541 and order one or all of them. We have other materials. Again, they can go to the website. This just really, it was a shocker for me. I mean, you know, but as an American it was, how come Americans don't know this? I have got to do something to wake up Americans.
What is sustainable feudalism? What is that? That's an interesting perspective you went about it. Explain why you titled that.
Well, sustainable feudalism, the United Nations, when I went to Cairo in 1994, it was all about sustainable development. And sustainable development came about as a result of the 1992 Rio Earth Summit. And there were only 25,000 people at that Earth Summit, and Prince Charles was there, and many of the CEOs from about 100 chosen corporations that he worked very closely with. And everybody was lobbying for something called Agenda 21 to be, quote-unquote, agreed to by the people of the world. Well, there were 6-7 billion people in the world at the time, and here we have 25,000 people saying they represent you and me, when the average person in the U.S. and worldwide didn't even know what in the world Agenda 21 was. And they say they, you know, it became a world, you know, a world thing. And so governments around the world, including our own, started to adopt, quote-unquote, sustainable development. There are many facets to sustainable development, whether you're talking climate change, whether you're talking reducing the number of people in the world, whether you're talking about, quote-unquote, using, making better, better use of the Earth's resources. There are a lot of variations to sustainable development, but the bottom line is it's really demonic. It really is a control mechanism to enslave the people of the world, because through the environmental agenda, Agenda 21, what it really says is that the people of the world cannot manage the resources of the earth, and therefore they will have to come in, the United Nations, and they will have to control everything, including you and me. That's really what the whole agenda is about. This is so diabolical. It is so heinous. It is so unbelievable. Now, for people who are in the environmental movement, they're going to say, I'm wrong. No, no, darling. I've been where you have not been, number one, depending if you're an NGO or you're a teeny bopper, 18 to 20 or 16 to 20 or whatever, and you've heard something that sounds good. You better start reading documents. You better start reading Agenda 21, because it's all about the control, total control of the world's assets. So with that, that's sustainable, feudalism. Where does feudalism come from? Feudalism comes from the divine right of kings to rule, whether it was the French or the British or the Dutch kings or the Italian, wherever, that they somehow were somebody way above you and me, and just because they were big and powerful and strong and controlled a large amount of land, that they could then say, well, you know, I control everybody who lives on this land too. And so in order to understand really what is happening in the world, you need to understand sustainable for sustainable development, and you need to understand where feudalism came. You know, the divine right of kings, where you could, if you were being protected by the king, he had the right to take 10 or 20% of your of whatever you grew. You had to ask his permission for everything you wanted to do. And if he needed an army, you were it. And so when we take a look at who runs and rules the world, and now we're making a big leap forward, because you see, in looking to identify the power players, when I wrote my first book, Prince Charles, The Sustainable Prince, not really, never in my life did I ever think I would write a book about Prince Charles. But I found that he was a major power player advancing the whole concept of sustainable development. And therefore, I started looking at the role of the British royal family. And that research led me to conclude that the United Nations was run and set up by the British royal family as a way of bringing all countries back under British rule. Now, if you do not think that that wasn't a Herculean idea, it was. And, I mean, I remember when I first concluded it, I had such a splitting headache, a headache of such magnitude, something I'd never had before, that I had to lay down for a half hour just to assimilate what I had pieced together. And I have to say to you, that was, oh, I don't know, 14 years ago, 13 years ago maybe, I have yet, in all my research, in all the interviews I've done, in all the other activities, to change my mind.
Okay.
And so when we take a look at really what's going on again, now you take a look at Agenda 21 through the eyes of, let's say, a very powerful family looking to rule the whole world. It's feudalism. And so in the movie, in the video, nobody's made a movie yet. In the video, Sustainable Feudalism, I go into all of this.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess I could mention that in feudalism, this is a system of government that has basically prevailed over most of human history. You have a very tiny ruling class, and everybody else is a slave or a serf. And, of course, this is what the sustainable development agenda, unfortunately, as you point out, is leading us towards. Now, I think since we only have an hour, Joan, perhaps we should get into the importance of the financial crisis, because I know you know a lot about that, and how the financial crisis is important to implement the agenda which the power elite have set for us. Could you comment on the role of this?
Yes. Okay. So, having discussed all the power players, one of the things that I started looking at is, okay, are we in world government, and what would we have in order to have world government? Well, as I started to identify the major pieces of world government, I realized something very interesting, and this leads up to the financial crisis. In 1944, the economic barriers between the countries of the world fell when the International Monetary Fund and World Bank were set up. In 1945, the political barriers between the countries of the world fell when the United Nations was set up. And there are a lot of other barriers, the World Health Organization. Then we get all the way to 1994. The United States passed the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, a 28,000-plus page bill that said we wanted free trade between nations. And remind me to talk about the WTO and the real meaning of it as we continue. And that's in my opinion. So the trade barriers, the World Trade Organization was set up, and the trade barriers between countries fell. In 1998, the International Criminal Court was set up. And for the first time in history since Rome, there was a people's court, a global people's court, that could try individuals for, quote-unquote, right now they just have two or three crimes, like crimes against humanity and genocide, but in the future they plan to add all kinds of other heinous reasons why you and I can end up at the International Criminal Court. That was set up in 1998, so the legal barriers between the countries fell. And then, you know, interestingly enough, we had Y2K. What was Y2K? After all was said and done, first of all, what they were able to do was really pull one over on the entire people of the world using media. And it was global propaganda. That's really what Y2K was. But more importantly, what Y2K did was it made every country of the world get on the computer system, the electronic system, so that they could be controlled that way. And so as I started studying all the barriers between the countries that had fallen, interestingly enough, the next barrier to fall would be the regulatory barrier. Now, in 1999, and this is very important, I mean, it might be a little dry to people, but it's very important, they set up an organization at an international place called the Bank for International Settlements. And at the Bank for International Settlements, they set up an organization called the Financial Stability Forum. And I did interviews at the BIS, and I did interviews with the new managing director at the time, and I did interviews even with Robert Rubin about what was this new organization, the Financial Stability Forum. It was comprised of the regulators from the G7 countries, and this was post Asian crises. And so they used the Asian crises to set up this idea of a global regulatory agency on the international level. And so I thought that the barrier, the regulatory barrier between countries had fallen. There were many other things that happened. In 1999, the United States repealed a very major law called the Glass-Steagall Act. And that was put in place in 1933 to protect the banking system back then. This is post-Great Depression. It was put in place because they had determined that the reason why we had the Depression was because the banks could bring stocks and bonds to market as well as sell them. And so the Glass-Steagall Act divided the banking activities at that time between commercial banks, where, you know, we used to get our mortgages and car loans, from the investment banks like Goldman Sachs, where they would concoct new investments and bring them to market, whether it was a stock, a bond, as we know, these CDOs, and derivatives and other exotic investments. And so that's what the Glass-Steagall Act was. In 1999, it was called, there was a call for banking modernization. We need banking modernization. And so they basically tore down and eliminated the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999. What did that do? That allowed banks to go back to pre-1933 times and issue stocks and bonds. They could buy brokerage firms, they could buy insurance companies, they could buy real estate companies. And so all of a sudden you had these huge, you had these banks that were becoming huge conglomerates in their own right. And there was nobody to oversee them. And so we have from 1999 until 2006, 2007, when all of a sudden, and in between there was 9/11, okay? And I'm sure we could do a whole lot on 9/11. In my opinion, 9/11 was planned and managed, just like the credit crisis and everything else. And there were many reasons for 9/11. We're not going to go into all of them, but the interest rates, the Federal Reserve said, oh, my goodness, we need to stimulate the economy. And so because of this huge, terrible thing that had happened, they reduced interest rates to 45-year lows. And they really helped create the credit crisis. All of a sudden, you had this huge housing boom. And everybody and their brother was out looking for the mega mansion. And, you know, it wasn't a matter of how much debt were they taking on. It was a matter of, quote, unquote, whether or not they could afford the payment. How silly, how stupid, how sad. And so we end up here in 2006, 2007 with a
If
contract.
I could just jump in, Joan. We had a very interesting interview just earlier this week with Dr. James Fetzer, who is the emeritus professor of philosophy of science, founder of the Scholars for 911 Truth. And so he's been working on this for quite a while, and he's come to the same conclusion that I have, which is that 911 was primarily organized and orchestrated and covered up by the CIA, the Mossad, and the Zionist forces in this country and around the world. So there's a very, very, very strong imprint or implication that Zionists carried out and have covered up 911. So when you talk about the royal family of Britain and everything like that, I think there's a little bit more to the story since they seem to have this enormous hidden power.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And let's just talk about that for a moment. The biggest surprise that I had in reading about Princess Diana is that her mother was a Rothschild. And so what that really means is that William will be the first Rothschild to sit on the British throne. And there has been a marriage back in the 1800s. Most of the aristocratic families were broke. And a lot of the very wealthy Jewish banking families started to intermarry into much of the British aristocracy. And so here we are. And there is a very, very powerful convergence, in my opinion, between the very powerful banking entities that rule the world and the British royal family.
So does that timing end up being pretty much when you had a lot of these round tables and that sort of thing getting together to start controlling the world?
Well, it depends on when you want to go back. When was there this emphasis to control the world? I think it started, the Rothschilds, and I'm not trying to be anti-Semitic, which I will be accused of, but look, this guy was brilliant. I mean, Papa Rothschild was Mayor Amschel Bauer. He was absolutely brilliant. He was not only brilliant, he was very, very, can't get the word, but he really knew how to make money. He really knew how to, you know. Anyway, he had five sons, create five banks, control all the banking in Europe. That was brilliant, you know? And I've written extensively about the role of Nathan Rothschild, one of his sons who he sent to England to start the Rothschild banking family in England, and how he became the financier for Cecil Rhodes. And Cecil Rhodes had this dream as a British aristocrat to make the whole world British, because that's what the Rhodes Scholarship Program is all about, because he said if the whole world were British and we're the finest race in the world, then we wouldn't have any more wars. And so, you know, there's been, in the 1800s and the 1900s and now the 21st century, I mean, we are really seeing the conclusion of all this power and all this planning, whether it's the Rothschilds, whether it's Cecil Rhodes, whether it's the British royal family. And we've come a long way in Agenda 21, and sustainable development and climate change is like their crown, you know? It's the final crown of everything that's happening. And you have very naive Americans who just, you know, I'm sure that they, when they listen to you, doctor, that it, you know, it's crazy, you know, you're nuts. And me as well. But they haven't done their homework.
Well, Joan, we've had four interviews with Dr. Tim Ball, who is Canada's first climatology PhD, and one of the real experts that has been willing to question this myth of global warming, which is nothing but a bunch of BS.
Right.
From a scientific point of view, it's incredibly weak. The only sustaining force behind it, of course, is this enormous propaganda machine. So people are told daily, you know, especially from the BBC, so a lot of it is coming out of Britain, but there's no scientific basis for it, and yet the scientific community itself has profited mightily because there's been enormous increase in research dollars for scientists who are willing to jump on this bandwagon. So the whole climate change thing is really fascinating perversion of science.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? In February, we had such awful snowstorms throughout the country, and all I could think of was God was answering the lie of climate change. I mean, you know, that's what he did. I mean, these people are so diabolical. They are so evil. It is so amazing. I have talked and interviewed Dr. He is one of the two scientists that came up with the climate warming theory, Dr. Mario. It won't come. Anyway, I've interviewed him, and I remember challenging him in a very, very important workshop where everybody and their brother was there from the whole environmental and oil, major oil companies, BP, all of the major oil companies were in this workshop, and he was giving his thing on climate change, and I raised my hand, and I was, believe me, I was one of the very, very few females there, and I challenged him on how could he know, based on, you know, trees being 50 million years old or something ostentatious like that. And he basically said, well, it was the computer model.
That's right. The whole thing is based on computer models. And,
right.
Joan, I've put together another website on this because this actually plays into my research strength because I've studied paleoclimates all my professional life. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I never took this whole scenario of man-caused global warming seriously. But if anybody's interested or if you're interested, I'm still working to build that site. It's www.naturalclimatechange.us. And, of course, my contention has always been that natural climate changes are with us always at different scales, different frequencies, different magnitudes. We've learned an awful lot about them in the last 100-some years, and they are much, 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 much greater than anything we've seen in the 20th century. And, in fact, so much data now shows that the climate's been cooling since 1998 worldwide. So the whole thing is predicated on just a fabricated lie. But let's move on to the financial crisis. I'm glad we touched those bases. But before we do that, perhaps you could tell me, before we jump into the credit crisis, why is it that this group that has this long-term plan for us uses these very, very pernicious hoaxes like climate change and like 911 to advance their agenda? I guess it just to keep everybody off base and fighting the wrong demons. So what do you suspect?
The king's new clothes. I mean, you know, look, they have to have, first of all, you have to have a forum. You have to have a group of people who basically are saying they know more than you. Then you have to have all those people that you're willing to buy and pay to support and say what you've said is real, okay? And, you know, when you look at a lot of this, it really is the United Nations has been set up as the fora for all of this, you know? It all comes through the United Nations, okay? And it is part and parcel of the average honest person who's working, who's trying to make a living, who's trying to keep everything together, versus those people who want what he has. And that is the story of life. But the deceit, deception, and distortion, as you know, goes back to the Garden of Eden. I mean, you know, Satan, the first sin in the world was not that Eve ate the fruit. It was the lies and the deceit and the deception that Satan painted for her to act. That's really what it was. I mean, you have a better response?
Well, it is fascinating to me that, like in George Orwell's book 1984, you know, ignorance is strength, freedom is slavery, war is peace. The population is conditioned to accept lies. And, you know, so you have to nod and smile when agree that 2 + 2 = 5. And it seems to me that if you compromise the intelligence and the integrity of your populace to that extent, that they're willing to accept these lies because to do otherwise would be too scary for them, huh. then you have control over their mind.
Well, I will agree with you on that 100%. It's all about control. It's all about, I mean, look, deceit, deception, distortion, that's lying. I mean, it is about somebody wanting what you and I have, and they will do. But you see, the conditioning, it is because people have allowed themselves to be taken by a lie. What are you? You are a truth seeker. Melody's a truth seeker. I'm a truth seeker. That is the difference between us and them. We are truth seekers. And so, you know, when we, and what are you and I trying to do? We're trying to wake up the other people who aren't really bothering, or they're involved in farming, or don't have time, or whatever the case may be, to understand what's really happening and what it means for them.
Yeah, yeah, and of course the powers that be have virtual control over of the media, all aspects of the media.
Yeah.
And so therefore they get to put their spin on events and keep everybody in a state of bewilderment and confusion. So in a sense, I don't blame the American people for their confusion and their ignorance. But I think it does take considerable amount of dedication and work and effort to pull off the scales from our eyes. It takes an enormous amount of time and energy, which thankfully you've put in and many others like yourself to try to get the word out. So we've discussed, the role of deception. Now, what's going on with this financial crisis that we don't know?
Okay, the financial crisis. Let me cut to the chase. The financial crisis is a very, very major move. As I said before we went on tape, that the financial crisis in the future will be written in such a way that it will be a very stark change in how we live and our freedom. The financial crisis. Now, in order to tear down the barriers between the countries of the world, I had talked about an organization called the Financial Stability Forum set up in 1999, in which only the G7 regulatory agencies were part of. And at that time, I was basically told that they were going to watch over the whole global architecture for any problems. Well, joke, ha, ha, ha. The 2008 credit crisis, we won't go into everything that created it, but we now see that as a result of the credit crisis, we have a very large hole in the foundation and the power and the position of the middle class in America, looking to make us, instead of a three-tier, a two-tier, the very poor and the very rich, feudalism at the very core, number one. Number two, the credit crisis, it has been set up in order to tear down all of the individual national regulatory laws and bring the national regulatory laws under the power and the position of a global regulatory agency. Now, the G20 in November of 2008, the last big thing George Bush did before Obama was elected, was he called together a meeting here in the D.C. area. I tried to get press credentials for that, and the White House told me that only invited press were going to be allowed. And so what happened is the G20 came together. The G20 had been set up for a number of years because many of the third world countries said, we're not part of the G7, G8 process. The G7 being the United States, Germany, Japan, Italy, France, Great Britain, and that's the G7. And then Russia joined in 1998, so it became the G8. And then there were countries like India and Malaysia and Mexico and Argentina and China and Australia and a number of other countries saying, hey, you know, we deserve to be part of what happens in the world. And so the coming together of the G20 was just a phenomenal thing. And then in April of 2009, Obama went to Buckingham Palace, and there they changed the Financial Stability Forum to the Financial Stability Board. And so now we have this very powerful organization that has been set up on the international level that basically is acting as a global regulatory agency for the world. It is comprised now not just of the G7 countries, but of the G20 regulatory agency. And I really thought when I started looking at the Dodd bill, and that bill is 1,400 pages long, that there would be a whole section on the international part of what was going on, and there's nothing. And so I am in the process of doing research to basically ask, because I've done interviews at the Financial Stability Board level, and ask them, you know, will every country have to vote through their parliament and Congress to be a member? Well, some will, like the U.S. was the response. But to my knowledge, the U.S. has never voted to allow our whole national regulatory system to become part of an international system. Now, what does this do? What's the bottom line here? It's really control of assets. Let me go back to the World Trade Organization for a moment, the WTO. The purpose, free trade, you don't need 28,000 pages for free trade, okay? The whole purpose of the WTO is that if you tear down all the barriers of trade between countries, that means the banks and the international banks and the central banks of the world don't have any barriers as far as money movement, whether they are going to take down the stock market in one country or whether they can take it down globally. And so now, in order to facilitate this kind of opportunity, you now need all the regulatory agencies to come under the power of a global regulatory agency that will control everybody and everyone affiliated with any part of the financial arena. Okay, that's number one. Number two, in the United States, the Federal Reserve has control and monitors certain banks and certain arenas. They do not have control over any kind of lending agency, including non-banks, like auto dealer credit companies or credit cards. They do not have control over credit unions, state chartered banks. They do not have control over the real estate industry. They do not have control over the insurance industry. Every state in the union has control over every kind of insurance that's offered, whether it's disability insurance, whether it is commercial insurance, whether it's liability insurance, whatever it is, every state has control. When you start reading all the things that they want to do and you read not only the Paulson plan, the Paulson blueprint issued in 2008, and then the Obama Foundation written in April of 2009, what you see basically is that there is a major, major, major opportunity for all of these other financial areas to be moved under the control of the Federal Reserve. So what is this? The credit crisis is a major plucking, a major transfer of all the financial areas that are not under the Federal Reserve. And what is the Federal Reserve? The Federal Reserve is a private corporation. And so you have a private corporation running and controlling the entire monetary system and business cycle of the whole United States. And now these whoever owns the Federal Reserve, and I would say to Congressman Ron Paul, you've done a great job, Ron Paul, but what you need to do when you're talking to Ben Bernanke is just ask him the bottom line question. Can you name the owners of the Federal Reserve, your major shareholders, please? And if not, can you provide them in writing? That's the bottom line. And when you know who owns and controls the Federal Reserve, then you will know what is happening. This basically is feudalism, financial economic feudalism, happening on a major scale. And that you can call it anything you want. You can rewrite history about it. You know, people have very short memories, which is too bad and sad. But the bottom line is we have a major plucking of the world's financial assets,
you know,
under the control of the central bank.
Joan, one of the things that I think people also need to be aware of is these guys feed off of the instability, using the word stability.
They control it.
Right.
They create it.
Right. And then you have countries like Argentina, and as a good example, is to say, okay, so if they take all our pension funds and they destabilize us and bring the monetary system down to nothing, they go back in, they'll build them back up, and then they'll go back in and feed off of them again.
Yeah, right. What do you consider what's happened in the stock market?
Same way, right.
The stock market lost 45% in September, October. You're absolutely right. These people know how to rape, rob, pillage, and plunder. And when you tear down the WTO and when you tear down the regulatory barriers, look at what they have. Look at the landscape, the playground that they've created. They now can do it, all the countries at once, okay? They don't have to worry about doing the U.S. and here and Argentina there and Brazil there and, you know, Portugal here, you know?
Well, and another thing is if we don't start holding these people accountable, then they just move on over to another arena, and Hank Paulson is a good example.
Yes. Yes. And so how do we hold them accountable? Okay. I think the American people have to start doing things differently. I think, first of all, you know, they have to understand, you know, when I went to my first global meeting, a friend of mine asked somebody who worked for the NSA, National Security Agency, very, very secretive intelligence agency here in the D.C. area. They asked what they should know about going on the international level, and this person said to them, well, we have a saying at the NSA, your friends are your enemies and your enemies are your friends. And, you know, as I have covered global meetings, I have just really thought about that a whole lot. First of all, the American people need to wake up. They need to know who the enemies are and who their friends are, number one. Number two, we need to start doing things a little differently. Start saving up before you buy that car instead of buying it on credit. We have to start going back to basics on how we live, and that's going to be very difficult for all of us, I assure you. The people who made it through the credit crises are basically people who had no debt or low debt or, if you will, manageable debt. Everybody else did not make it.
So,
well, if we could, excuse me, Melody, if we could just ask you to follow up on your own question, Joan, who owns and controls the Federal Reserve?
The Federal Reserve is owned and controlled by most of the international banks. I am told, and, you know, I have a list somewhere, I am told it's, you know, J.P. Morgan. I'm told it's Goldman Sachs. I'm told it's the Schiff Banks. I'm told it's the Rothschild Banks. And, you know, one of the things that I show in one of my videos, I think it might be Sustainable Feudalism, is that one of Queen Elizabeth's forefathers, King William, was the largest investor in the Bank of England. And the Bank of England was the second or third private corporation to lend money to the government at interest without the principal having to be repaid. And so you cannot tell me that if King William invested only in the Bank of England that he's not invested, or one of his forefathers or the British royal family, let's just put it like that, is not invested in the Federal Reserve. Andrew Jackson over and over again lamented about the fact that it was the European aristocracy that were the owners of the Second National Bank, and that it was the Europeans that were interfering with the financial strength of America, and that's one of the reasons why he was closing the bank.
So movies that that people could watch, or books that people could read to get up to speed on this. Years ago, I watched The Money Masters, which I think does a pretty good job of explaining the economics and the people behind much of American history. It's a completely alternative view of American history. It's an economic view of American history. Who gets to control the currency becomes the most important question.
Absolutely.
And so you have this passing back and forth between the federal government and private international bankers seven or eight times in our history, and then all the assassinations and wars that went along with the with this deliberate program to wrest control of the currency from the federal government into the hands of the private bankers where it now resides. So you're saying that this coup, that it was a long-term, slow-motion coup that affected American history, is now almost complete in the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The power that is being, this whole thing of global, tearing down the barriers, first of all, the trade barriers, but more importantly now, the regulatory barriers, and everybody coming under the Financial Stability Board. I mean, I've interviewed at the G20. I mean, I interviewed Mario Draghi, who is the managing director. I got five questions, asking about the position and the power and how they were going to operate, you want to know, and look, I went to that press briefing where Mario Draghi was versus going to Obama's press briefing. Why? I knew where the power was. Why would I want to go to the Obama and the G20 press briefing when the real power is at the Financial Stability Board? That's exactly what's happening. There is a major global coup. This is like the climate change, if you will, except we're playing with real money, sort of, even though it's paper. This is the climate change, the financial climate change.
One of the things right before we close here is I also wanted to bring up the fact that even though the individuals can try to preserve their ability to stay out of being in debt, something that was brought up this morning when I was listening to a program was the fact that we have our own local governments going into debt.
Yes.
And then that puts us into bondage.
Yes. So we're in bondage on many levels. We're on bondage with the personal level. We're on bondage with when it comes to the school board. We are on bondage when it comes to the municipality, the local municipality, the county municipality, the state municipality, and the federal the federal government.
And again, with like someone like Hank Paulson, you find that, you know, even with what they're doing in their private life and their so-called organizations, they usually often have a tie-in with what they are doing on a business level. And again, I like to bring up the fact that he's been on the board of directors, governors with Nature Conservancy, and and I find that highly.
These people are all incestuous. Look at Timothy Geithner. You know, Timothy Geithner was at the IMF. He was at the Federal Reserve. Now he's at Treasury. He was the protege of Larry Summers and Robert Rubin. Okay. You can look at the bio of all these people. It's the very same kind of thing.
Right.
There is a website that kind of opened my eyes at one point called People with the Infinite Bios. And Marie Strong is a former member of the Little Crestone community where I have a house and in Colorado. And he is one such whose biography is almost impossible to believe. It's almost impossible to believe that one person has done so many things.
I've interviewed him about four times.
What's that?
I've interviewed him four
yeah.
times. Yeah.
And your comment then about him would be what?
He came basically from rags to riches. He ended up becoming a very close commandant of David Rockefeller. He worked very closely with Prince Charles on sustainable development. Interestingly enough, as you know, he was the Secretary General of both Earth summits. Just amazing, unbelievable. But you see, you know, he had relatives who showed that he'd be willing to sell his soul.
Yeah, so it would be common then to see that amongst the real power players, there would be this tendency to have unbelievable connections and an infinite bio. They somehow managed
right.
to accomplish this,
right.
so many directorates on different boards, and they supposedly have written, you know, lots of books and published lots of articles and,
mm-hmm.
you know, gotten 1,000 mm-hmm. awards, and they're members of the Knights of this and the Knights
right.
of that. And
yeah.
and they wind up with a certain kind of a profile, which I think we can start to use now to identify these people.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it's, you know, we're now time to come to a close here, and I just was wondering if either one of you both have a closing comments, and I again want to thank you very much, Joan, for being gracious enough to do this interview with us.
My comment very simply is this, that God sets up kings and he takes kings down.
And Eric?
Yeah, well, I would just again like to thank you both. And, of course, especially Joan for taking the time to join us. I find it so very educational. I always come away with an idea for a book, or I'll try to get on your website and get a few of your videos, because I already have a couple of your DVDs and have found them extraordinarily educational. In fact, I've even summarized your, if you don't mind, one of your videos on global government, your DVDs on global government, and it's on my website, 911nwo.com. I am like you. I'm trying to understand what's going on in the world, and I think that is perhaps the most important work that we can do, and then try to share that information. I know that since 911, I've worked a lot trying to understand what's really going on, and I think thanks to people like yourself, my understanding now is light years ahead of what it was in September 11, 2001.
Well, that's great. I'm honored and I'm humbled. And so whenever you want to do a conference up at your college, university, I'll be there.
Okay. Thanks very much, both of you.
And Joan, thank you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. God bless you. God bless America.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.